new little gadget here, so hopefully that will work. And then I'll turn this one on as well. Give me a second. So this is really an unofficial part, as I mentioned before. I've changed the look and feel of this presentation from the others because I don't want it to be look like, feel like, anything like the other presentation, because it's really not. It's a different presentation altogether. And some of you know, I know in my Sunday school class you know, that I've shared with you that probably for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 months, I've been sort of burdened by a lot of things. Not only my own walk with the Lord, but, you know, other things in terms of our country and things in terms of our church, not just this church, but the worldwide church. Yeah. And so I'm going to put a couple of things in here and talk about that are my views only, nobody else's, so they're just mine. But we'll talk about them and hopefully begin to get some idea of what we're doing, if I can get back out of your way here so you can see a little better. So this is the sixth part, except this is predictive. History is not reportive, so it's going to be different in a lot of ways. We're going to look at church trends, we're going to look at political trends, social trends, and then we're going to take a reality check of what else is in play. I'll end about that. What else is in play? And then we're going to discuss directions that they could go, and then we're going to look at what not only churches should be doing now, but what we should be doing now. And I'll hand these out, so you'll have those, and you can take a look at them. Don't read ahead, though. Let me present this as it kind of naturally flows. So one of the things else I want to mention is I've taken, you know, most of you know that I'm a reader, avid reader, and I've been reading a lot. And one of the books I've read is one called The Age of the Unthinkable, which is kind of an interesting book. I've got another one I read called The Survivor, which I didn't bring. But there's, you know, obviously church history. And there's a number of these kind of books, like David Jeremiah's book, which is a new book for him, called Living with Confidence in a Chaotic World. And then some of the end time prophecies and some of those kind of things as well. We can talk a little bit more about those later. One book I didn't bring, but it's probably the best prophecy book that we have. It's a book by a guy named John Walborn, and he is I don't know whether he's still doing it or not, but he was a New Testament professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, probably one of the top scholars in terms of prophecy in the U.S., and has written many, many books. And if you ever see him, I've got his name in the book that I've got there called Every Prophecy of the Bible, kind of an interesting book to have in your repertoire. So anyway, that's what we're going to talk about. And I'm going to use some statistics that I have to kind of make a point I want to make. And these come out of a report called an Harris Report. And this is a report that's done every few years. And they sample things, and they've done it in 90 and 2001, 2008. And they ask questions and they compare things over time. And I've got a website if you want to pull the report. I've got a web link for it.
And I would recommend people to go and look at that, because you sent it to me.
It's interesting. It's about 50 or 60 pages long, and I've only pulled a few things out of here. But if you look at this chart here, I think my thing is about to die. Good. Battery's probably about dead. All right, so I'll just walk over here and point to it. How's that? When you look at here, this is the number of people in this area. This is the percentage in each of the 3 years. And so if you take a look at, for example, the number of Catholics, in 1990 there were about 46 million. This is in the U.S. That's about 26% of the Christian population, or the people that answered the survey, actually, about 230 million. In 2001, there's 50, and in 2008, there's 57. We'll talk about what that is. These are all self-identified. They send a survey out, and you identify who you are and what you believe. There's no test for accuracy, so it's just who you think you are. You know, if you think you're a born-again Christian, you check that off. If you think you're not, you don't check it off. A lot of different things. So you can see Catholics are holding pretty steady. Other Christians are about 50%, but you can see a decline. from 60 to 52 to about 51. And I would suspect if you get the latest data in 2010, it's below 50%, maybe 48 or 49%. But you come down here to things like nuns, people who say, I don't have any religion. You see, that's gone from 8% up to 14 and 15%, probably higher than that today as well. And then the ones who either don't know, which is an interesting answer, or they refuse to answer, which probably means they don't know or they're a nun and they just don't want to admit it. So these two together have gotten pretty big. This is 10, and it's going to, it's about 20% now. So you can take a look at that and kind of see where it is. The number of people who proclaim to be Christians is up, absolute number, but the percentage of Christians in the population is down. So this is kind of the overall trends of people who claim that they're religious. And that's just the first thing to look at. Now, the Catholics are up due to the Latin immigration. We could guess that probably. There's 46 million, and there's about 11 million up, and we know there's about 10 or 11 million undocumented illegal aliens, whatever you want to call them, here in the U.S., that are part of these surveys. So that's probably what the bulk of that is. Other Christians are up 10%, and you can see that that's the smallest. It'll work for about 2 seconds. So you can see that it's the smallest, that 10% right there. And so that's the smallest of all of the groups. The nuns have grown 37%. So there's something going on, and the don't know and refused are up 15%. So there's something going on in the general population that has those two at 37 and 15% of the population growth. What is that? 52% of the growth comes in the either I don't know or won't say, or I don't have any religion. Kind of a scary thought when you project that out a little bit in the future. There's a lot of other trends. I only pulled four of them because I want to make some points with these. One of them is what's called a millennial, and those are the kids that are, probably born in the last 10 or 15 years. They're early adults now, so they were born 20, 25 years ago. This survey calls them millennials. 72% of them say they're more spiritual than they are religious, which you say, well, that's not so bad. But what does that mean? When you get down in it, they don't read the Bible. And the more you try to measure what they have, the fewer you find they're committed to anything. They don't pray. They don't go to church. They don't do anything that has to do with organized religion at all. And so you see that, you know, this 72% of spiritual and religious may be New Age, maybe, glow stones in their pocket or wherever else they're, you know, worshiping, but it's kind of an interesting deal. They don't read the Bible at all.
But before you move, they also don't believe in absolutes.
Oh, that's right. And certainly not biblical absolutes.
Right.
I mean, they may believe in death and taxes, but they don't believe in much of anything else. Britain today, and we look at them because they sort of are a rabbit out in front of us. We can look at them and see where things may go for us. Half of the people in Britain now call themselves Christian, and that's down considerably. Not too much different from us, by the way. But if you look at this, religious belief has gone down, and if you want to look at British churches, if you've ever been there and you go to their churches, they've got beautiful churches. But they're as empty as they can be, and they're as dead as they can be. And people don't go to church. They don't listen to the pastors or the priests. It's not part of their way of life. They've just abandoned the church altogether. Although some of them may consider, it's, again, this is self-identification, check themselves off as Christians. Now, the nuns are gaining significantly. They're getting up to be a pretty big number. They're going to be bigger than Catholics before long. So you think about voting blocks, and you think about interests politically in the country, and you can see these no-religion people, and that means not Buddhists, not Mormons, not Jehovah's Witnesses, not any of that. It's no religion whatsoever. Yet there are some bright spots. If you look at Africa, Africa is on fire for God.
Yeah.
And there's two things going on there. One is there's a fight between Islam and Christianity. And they're both running about 50% of the population. But they're both growing at a significant rate. And we see a lot of the fresh fire in the Christian movement comes out of Africa,
comes out of Asia, comes out of Latin America. And so while we used to call it the dark continent, it's not so dark anymore. I mean, there's still elements of it that are, but the light of the Lord is actually reaching in there. And so there's some things that are happening there which are kind of interesting. If you try to summarize what these things are, and I've got a couple of other charts that will give you more detail, the percentages that are Christians are down. The spiritualism is growing, but it doesn't mean prayer, it doesn't mean church attendance, and it doesn't mean biblical understanding at all. The percentages of nuns are growing, and the details of the denominations, I'll show you those in a minute, show that the key drop-off is in what this survey calls the mainline churches, with the exception of Catholic. Catholic is holding up because of the influx of Mexican-Americans predominantly coming into this country. So this is an eye test, and there's two of these in here. But if you look at this, you can kind of see that Baptists were 19%, now we're 15.8. This is the, Catholics are kind of holding their own at about 25%. But mainline Christianity has dropped from 18.7 to 12.9. And you can look down here and see who they are and how much they've dropped. And if you want to take an interesting look, look at the Episcopalian or Anglican Church. 3 million in 1990, 2.4 million in 2008. Presbyterians down some, not a lot, 2%. Lutherans down some, not a lot. Methodists down 5%. So you can see, there's a lot of drop-off and decline coming down here. And then there's this thing called generic Christian. And these are the other Christian religions other than Pentecostal. And they lump Mormons in here, and they lump Jehovah's Witnesses in here. And you can see where in unspecified Christian, which is really not much different than non-denominationals, these are getting bigger. And I think it's because people are fleeing this, going into something that's a little softer, maybe a little easier to find for them. But this is an interesting statistic. Born again, look at the numbers there, pretty small. Now, again, this is in generic. I've got another statistic on that, which is also telling. Pentecostals are down, their Pentecostals are actually up from 1.8 to 2.4, and you can see some of these others. Pretty low numbers. Now, when you get over to the Churches of Christ and Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, Mormons, you look at these and you say, it's an interesting thought that in this country, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, a lot of these religions that are pretty small generate a lot of energy out in the communities. We see them riding their bicycles, we see them doing whatever, they're carrying their tracks coming to your door, but they're really pretty small, yet they, in my notes say, they bark much louder than they bite. They're fairly small percentage-wise. Yeah, fine.
On the one that you said was evangelical born again, is that included in the above?
Some
the
of it Catholics is. I don't know what that is.
Baptists.
I don't know what that is. I'm going to show you another statistic on that when we get back down here. And then you can see the agnostic and atheist down here and Jews. And Jews, again, this is Jews that are religious, not Jews, not what you would call Jews that were born in Jerusalem or born in Israel. This doesn't count nationality, it counts faith. So if they claim they're a Jew by faith, they get counted here. And you can see these are fairly small numbers out of the 228 million that were counted. Two other demographics are interesting also. In mainline Christians, about 11.2 million, other Christian groups, 56 million. So you can see this is where Baptists fit in this particular grouping. Catholics are about 10 million. About 77 million, only 45% of those consider themselves born-again believers. You have to ask yourself, what are the other 55% if they're not born-again believers? And I think that gives you an idea of the makeup of the church, in terms of its depth of understanding of, revelation and personal relationship with God. The other thing that's interesting is the gender view. And I've circled a couple of numbers here because this thing won't last. But you can see in the Baptists, 57% across the nation are women, 43% are men. You can see that holds pretty much true till you get down to the Eastern religions, where 53% and 52% are men, and the smaller is women. But nuns, 60% are men, 40% are women. So it's pretty obvious that what we're doing is, as a group, we're losing the male side of the Christianity side. I mean, we're losing everywhere, but the male part is really being lost to the churches today. They're either not going anywhere, or they're in these generic don't know, don't care categories, or they're down in the nuns. So there's a lot of things there that are important for us, and things that are things we got to think about as a church and where we go. And we see that in our own fellowship. I mean, we've seen it for years where, you know, a husband doesn't come, but a wife comes. And it's not that he can't come, but he won't come. You know, he sees no value and doesn't come for that. One other thing I want to talk about is the age view. This is another one that's pretty revealing. This top line is the population in general. So, you know, 22% of the people are 18 to 29. But only 11% of that population group come to the Baptist churches. 37% and 21% are over 50 years old. So you see a huge disparity in what we're talking about here. We do have some median adults here, not maybe as much as some of the others. We're kind of low there. From a Baptist perspective, these two things right here are kind of a scary thought for us, and it probably mirrors in our own church. You know, we have some children, not a lot. We don't have a lot of parents bringing their children. Most of the people we have are 50 and above, and you know, they're adults. They've lived their life. They've come, you know, here to, you know, either they've retired here. They come to spend their time in church, and we see a lot of that. And it's not much different, although some of these are a little different. You can pay attention to those. The Jewish faith has got more children. You know, they're a little more evenly split, a little more, and that's because they hold on to their own pretty well. You know, if they're little, they get bar mitzvah and they join the church and they come to the church, and most of them come twice a year anyway, so it's not like they're real religious, but they do come. But Muslims, on the other hand, and Eastern religions, look at this, 42% are less than 29, 45% are less than 49. It sort of tells you that if the Muslims don't have very many old members. I mean, you can draw your own conclusions on that, but, you know, this is where they're heading. And this is where they're making the inroads. They're making inroads in the youth of the world in these areas. And it is because of the kind of the brand of theology that they preach. And the nuns, again, most of the nuns are in this 30 to 50 age, but they're coming up. You can see here, you know, there's 70% of them are under 49 years old. So we see the next 20 years, this is going to be like a snake that swallows a squirrel, right? It's just going to kind of, the bump is going to kind of move down through. And so we see these bumps that are going to go through the denominations. And so if you look at it and you say, what does that mean? I mean, it means that as a church, we're having to do some things. We're, you know, we're trying to do things, but our natural appeal is lessening in some church groups. And we've got to find out why that is the case. And if that wasn't enough, the political trends that we have are happening in front of us. We know the financial markets are unstable, and I'm going to tie this in a minute, so just bear with me. The taxes and fees are going up. We know that debt is increasing geometrically. In our own country, we owe more than we can pay back. We don't have the income to pay the debt that they have. We're going to be at the point where we don't have the income to pay the interest on the debt. And that's going to be in about another 8 or 9 years. So we're in a real significant problem. What I think is going to happen is, we're going to see new taxes, but the meager deductions we have are going to start going away because they're going to have the money and they're going to find a way to get it. And that's going to drive some changes for us. Healthcare costs are going to go up. Government control's up. Our freedom of action is going to decline. We've got states that are almost bankrupt. We've got countries that are bankrupt. You know, you've got Greece and Spain. There's probably two or three more behind that. You know, we've got open borders. We've got immigration that's chaos for us right now. And our populations are becoming balkanized. And what I mean by that is, you know, we used to be a melting pot. People would come in. They would assimilate. They would learn the language. They would get a job. They would speak English. And they would become part of the fabric of America. But today, balkanization means they don't do that. They come in, they stay in their community, they keep their Spanish, they keep their, you know, Laotian, their Vietnamese, their Bulgarian, they're whatever it happens to be, and they sort of try to push their ways out on the American society. So I think we're not the melting pot any longer, we're the salad bowl. And each element in the salad is distinct and never gets blended in, and that's really bad for our country, and I think we're seeing that. Muslims are becoming a growing force in Western country, but we're seeing a lot more violence from them as they try to enforce their views, as they try to enforce the things, you know, this cartoonist that published a cartoon about Muhammad, and they're trying to kill the guy. I mean, look at the political cartoons that are in this country. We don't go out and shoot somebody because of a political cartoon, but they do, and so it's a pretty scary time. And so to pull all this together, governments are talking about getting together and doing things together, and they call this global governance, and they're talking about linking financial systems and economies together and all that, and we're seeing it now. And my question is, you know, will one world government be far behind? I don't think it will, and I think we see the seeds of that planted. I don't think we're there yet, but if you were to plot trends, you would see the trends going in that direction. So I think the political trends are mixing into all of the things that are happening, and we wonder why some people don't come to church. Well, part of it is they're broke. You know, they're working, they're trying to find a job, they're depressed. A lot of things are going on, and they're not turning to the church for the help that they need. They're not coming to us for that, and we need to figure out why that's the case. And again, social trends play into this as well. You know, so you've got the geopolitic numbers of the churches that we've looked at, and then you've got all these political trends, but the social trends are probably scary as well, and we've looked at these for years. And you know, we see, you know, teen pregnancy, we see abortions, we see drug use, we see alcohol use, but young people aren't coming to church. They're not bringing their kids to church. They don't see as much significance in religious instruction any longer. God is being forced into a smaller and smaller place in our life. We call it secularism here. And, you know, we're comfortable now that God is not in government and God is not here and God is not there. That's not the way it was. It's not the way it was when we started the country. Certainly not what the founders had in mind. But it's kind of where we are because God is being pushed and shoved into smaller, smaller segments of our society. And we're watching that happen. And most of us have seen that happen in the last 40 years. Right. You know, more and more and more. You know, prayer out of the schools, and it's been kind of a cascade. You know, lack of a knowledge of Christian fundamentals. I can't tell you how obvious this is if you talk to people. There are people that believe things about the Bible that are just not true.
Right.
And they don't know any better. And the reason they don't know any better is they never read the Bible. They never studied the Bible. They don't have to spend the first second reading the book. And so what's happened is the churches have begun to draw those people that are somewhat spiritual, somewhat drawn, but they do it through entertainment. They bring them through entertainment services and not worship services, and we see that today. Some of these mega churches have 10 or 11,000 people on roll. Now, they don't all show up on Sunday, but, you know, when they do, they have 5 or 6,000, and they come for the entertainment. I mean, it's high-energy rock bands. It's, you know, real energetic preaching. You can turn on television and watch these TV preachers that have auditoriums full of people listening to what they have to say. The question really is, what do they know about God? I mean, I think that's the open question. I think a lot of us have that thought about it. And there's not much real Bible teaching going on. You know, what there is a lot of feel-good type stuff and a lot of stuff that people are doing to get them to come and feel good about church and feel good about coming and have it be a fun place to come. And they don't really focus much on Bible study. And I think service opportunities are going away. If you look across the convention, let's just take the Baptists, for example. And I don't know what the number is, but a lot of churches have done away with Sunday night service. Why? Because nobody comes. They've done away with Wednesday night services or Wednesday nights in abbreviated service. And you know, so we're seeing a lot of the traditional places. We did away with church training 10 or 15 years ago, right, where we had a 5 o'clock hour where you would come get some kind of training. We're seeing a lot of that gone. And so I think opportunities are disappearing. And people who are interested in that are not getting fed, not seeing that. And so we're not doing too much of these anymore. And also, lowering of the morality and the standards. There's so many churches today that accept things that they wouldn't have accepted 30 years ago. the lack of morality in the churches today is kind of astounding. I mean, we don't need to be the judge of that in particular, but we certainly need to stand against it. We certainly need to know the right from wrong. But, you know, there's all sorts of things, and you could reasonably say right is wrong and wrong is right. And people who do things that are very commonplace, you know, they announce them now to the world, and they would have been embarrassed to say something about them 20 years ago. And so we just see, and it's because the world has accepted more of it. It's become more of the norm. And the more you talk about something like that, the more it's accepted, and the more it's taken, and the more it's built into the fabric of society. And so I think we've seen a lowering of morals from a biblical standpoint. And I'm talking strictly a biblical standpoint here. If the Bible has a problem with something and calls it out that way, as Christians, that ought to be a focus of ours. Homosexuality, transgender, pedophilia, it's pedophilia, not so much, but, you know, we see that in churches today. We see some of that. But, you know, there are churches that have made decisions to have homosexual pastors and priests. And I don't mean used to be. I mean practicing now. So they're in willful violation of God's law, yet they're put up to teach the Word of God. And I think you're seeing that degeneracy in the church across the board, and that's driving people away. Mostly in the mainline denominations, because they're the ones that have gone through the big split and the fight over that. And, of course, then we come to the, you know, higher divorce rates, and when you and I know Jim would validate this, when you talk to people that are getting a divorce, faith is never part of the equation. Why are they getting a divorce? It's not that one's faith oriented and one isn't. It has to do with other things. Faith is not even part of the equation any longer, and that's a sad thing for us. You know, obviously single parent families, abortion, over 40 million of them so far, drugs and alcohol, all of this stuff is in the social trend. So it's mixing out there. All of this together is creating this soup that we're trying to figure out how to minister to. And it's creating some problems for every single church. I think I made one comment in here that the church is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic to get the best seat. But they don't even notice the iceberg in front of them, and they're heading straight for it, and they don't see it. They're just, you know, they're doing whatever the little thing of the minute is, and it's kind of a scary thought. I come back to what the Bible says, because I know as we say, we're a people of the book, and we want to follow the book, we want to do what the book says, we want to adhere to what the book calls us to do. And in Matthew 24, I want to just call your attention to that chapter. I've got that in the handouts. I've got the verses to read there. And Jesus is on the Mount of Olives. And I'm going to paraphrase this. And in verse 6, he says, "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginnings of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you'll be hated by all nations because of me. At this time, many will turn away from the faith and betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase in wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." And what Jesus is talking about here is the second coming, not the rapture. He's talking about the second coming. And so he's got a lot of things coming. And we're seeing wars and rumors of wars now. We see them every day. There's wars breaking out. There's, you know, aggressive things going on. And I haven't even brought up the ones that are in Daniel and Isaiah and the others that speak of Israel. Israel is its own greatest sign, you know, for the final season of the church age. And we know the founding of Israel in 1948 and the retaking of Israel back as a city under the Jews in 1967 are both key points that were forecast as part of these end of time activities. And this is not an end of time discussion, but I got to bring it in because I think all of this is mixing together. And if we don't get the urgency of what's happening, we'll miss some of the things we've got to be involved in. We're seeing we're seeing, this is the beginnings of birth pains. So it's just like a woman in labor. You know, she has the birth pains early, and then they start coming more and more frequently until the end when, you know, they come very, very rapidly. And so these things will come at different times during the period. People will turn away from the faith, betray and hate each other. I would say today, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes more, we're in the process of what we would call the apostate church now. Right. And I'll talk about that. And so all of this will happen. This is really talking about the second coming, though. And remember, the second coming comes 7 years after the beginning of the tribulation. And the rapture, or what we call the taking away of the church, there are no signs for that. That can be any time. That could be now. It could be tomorrow. It could be 3 weeks from now. There are no signs. But the one thing we know is we can't predict the date and the time, but the seasons can be predicted because we see the signs. Just like they saw in the time of Noah, they began to see the signs of what was coming. They just didn't pay attention to them. In Revelation, the book of Revelation, the first three chapters of that are written to the church on earth. And chapter 3, they write to some churches, two of which I want to talk about. This is the church in Philadelphia and the church in Laodicea. There are many people that say, well, those are just the seven churches in Asia. Well, there were actually other churches there as well. But then theologians will say, well, those seven churches represent the seven types of churches that we've had during the church age. And others will add to that, they not only represent that, but they represent the sequential view of how the church will move over time. And so Laodicea is the last church in the church age. Philadelphia is the next to the last church in the church age. So we'll talk about this. Philadelphia is the church of the open door. It's a church where God has propped the door open. God has given them the keys to ministry. They're weak, but they're faithful. And God has said, hang on, do what you're doing. Keep spreading the word. Keep being a witness and hold on to the end. Laodicea is the lukewarm church. And I've got the text in there. You can read that. The lukewarm church. And he says, I would spit you out of my mouth because you're neither hot nor cold. And what that means to me is they don't know or care. They don't read the Bible. They don't care about it. They don't know about the things of God, and they don't care. They come to church for other reasons. They're not coming to worship God and do the things that God has called them to do. Certainly not come to do Matthew 28, you know, they go and, you know, witness and baptize and all that. They didn't come to do that. And so these two churches represent the church of the end times. And in Laodicea, it's the only church that he has no positive things to say about. And he comes to the end and he says, what you should do is buy some gold from God that has been refined in the fire. And what that means is they need to go find somebody who's been purified to come into their midst and teach them and work with them and drive them back to where they need to be. Because if they don't, he's going to spit them out of his mouth. And I think that's kind of where we're headed today. Laodicea is a wishy-washy church that panders to the people, and it doesn't take a stand on anything. It's just there, you know, to get people to come through the door. I want to come to a point that I call the reality check now, and I want to talk about a couple of things. And again, this is my thought. I'm not saying this is, you know, Moses didn't come down with tablets and hand this to me. I think the church age is coming to the end. I think we see prophetic signs that say that the church age is close. I don't know what that means. I don't know whether it's going to be at least 7 years from now, but I don't know what it means. But I don't think it's going to be too long. I think we see too many signs coming. And the Bible tells us that it will come like a thief in the night. And what that means is it will come when we least expect it. It will not come with signs. It will come quickly. And when it comes, we've got to be awake and be ready. And it's critical that Christians understand the urgency of the situation and take action. I'm going to explain something called the sand pile theory in a minute. I talked about that when I did the last section that I did on church history. But, you know, should the Lord tarry a bit, I want to give you a couple of thoughts. I also believe income tax deductions like home mortgage and charitable deductions are likely to go away. If they don't go away entirely, they'll be means tested. Right. So the more you make, the less you'll be able to give and have it deducted. And I want to ask you a couple of questions because you got to think this way. This is what my book called The Survivor tells me. What will you do if the home mortgage deduction is phased out? I mean, if you've got your house paid off, you don't care. But if you don't, you do. And we can witness what's happened in the housing industry when things have happened to upset it, because people are levered out the wazoo. They've got more house than they can afford. They can't sell it. They can't get rid of it. The interest rates are high. And if they don't even get the deduction, it's going to make them even worse. What will the church do if the charitable deduction is phased out? I mean, you have to ask yourself, will you continue to give what you give if you don't get a tax write-off? A lot of us will. We'll continue to give because that's what we're supposed to do. The tax write-off was something we got, which was a benefit, but it wasn't why we gave. Although there are a lot of people in the church who give for that reason, and we see, and Daryl will tell you, that in the month of December, we get about 3 months' worth of income for people to meet their year-end tax numbers. They may still give, they may not. I think we'll see a decline if that happens. And I think if we don't stop it, we're going to see this within a year or two. It's got to come. They're starved for money. And so what does the Lord tell us? What are we to do for preparing ourselves and preparing, you know, our church? And, oh, gosh, wow, how was that? Let me put this back. Yeah, the battery's about shot, so that's probably why it's doing that. Oh, Max, you install updates to your computer. I'm not going to do that.
If it's Windows, it'll probably hijack it anyway.
Yeah, Windows blocks some startup. Oh, good. Hang on, I hate to do this, but I've got to kill this out.
Okay.
Need to update your computer, man. Best laid plans. Okay, so now let me back up. Okay, so one quick, I've done that. Yeah, Sandpile theory. I want to talk about Sandpile theory. Sandpile theory is an interesting theory, and I read this thing. I read it a couple of times, and I thought this guy is nuts. And it's in the age of the unthinkable. But as you think about it, it makes some sense. The Sandpile theory says this: I have sand in a big bucket, and I begin to pour it on the floor. At some point, when it reaches a certain height, the sand pile collapses and makes itself wider. And you pour more on, it collapses and makes itself wider. Well, it'd be an interesting thought if you could figure out when it's going to happen. And you knew when the next grain of sand would cause the sand pile to fall. Now, I don't know why people do this, but he got some IBM guy to go spend about a year working on it, and working on this math, trying to predict that. And the reason is, it connects with what we see happening in the world. Right now, if you follow the stock market, you go on every day and you look at what's happening, and then all of a sudden the market will drop 1,000 points, and you don't see anything out there that made you think that, but some little thing happened somewhere that caused this gigantic calamity. The first time we saw this was in 1914. We saw it when Archduke Ferdinand, who was the crown prince of Austro-Hungary, was killed by a Serbian student who had heard a fiery speech about nationalism. He was killed, and that started World War I. 27 countries got into it before it was over. Millions of people died. And you think, who would have read the newspaper and saw some archduke killed in, you know, Czechoslovakia somewhere, would have ever started World War I? But it did. And people began to look at, why didn't they see that? Why didn't they see the signs? So this whole idea of the sandpile theory is to try to figure out when and how the sand pile falls and when the drops of sand could do it. And then you could mathematically begin to look at trends, and with big computers you could do all that kind of stuff. And as we look at all of the things going on in the world today, you have to say things are out of control. I mean, everything's out of control. It's not just finances. It's our political system. It's our, it's our religious systems. It's our environment. I mean, everything we've got is in chaos. How do you predict and do something in a mode that we like to do, which is, I've studied, I know, I kind of predict what's going to happen, I'm going to make these assumptions and, you know, these investments. You can't do that very well. And so it falls into the sandpile theory. Now, it turns out they never could solve that problem. I'll short circuit that whole discussion. And one of the reasons why is we're not sand. Sand, if it's wet, it holds better. If it's dry, it holds better. But you and I, if we're considered to be a grain of sand, we can take individual action, which will stop the sand pile if we know what we're doing, or if we, just by dumb luck, make some change. And so they suddenly decided they couldn't do it, but then they begin to look at things like resiliency and how do we get to a point where we're not affected by these things. And so I've looked at that, and I've read this Age of the Unthinkable. It's an interesting book. If anybody wants to read it, you're welcome to borrow it, look at it. It's a good one to go to sleep at night by. Being a survivor, Christian, but it's an interesting thing. And so what he says is, what we have to do is learn to be resilient. We have to learn to be resilient, and we have to learn to be flexible. So we won't even see the signs when the sand pile is about to, hear music, sand pile is about to fall. How do we become more resilient? I'm gonna start to meddle here a little bit. Meddle not only with myself, but meddle in terms of the church too. But how do we become resilient? Well, we better become self-sufficient. You know, if you think the only place to get beans and corn and tomatoes is at Kroger, you better wake up, because what if the trucks can't deliver? What if there's no gasoline to deliver? Where do you find this stuff? Where do you eat? And the way you do it is you go to farmers markets, and you do things like our parents and grandparents did. They didn't go to the grocery or the Walmart and stock up on everything. They bought, you know, 2 or 3 weeks worth at a time, and they kept it as kind of a stockpile, and they worked off of it, and they really became had simple lives. So if there was a gasoline strike and they were in the middle of Kansas and had a month's worth of food, what did they care? Wasn't a problem. You know, they had ways to deal with it. Now we can't do what they did. We're different than they are. It's different day and time. But as best we can, we need to figure out how to get ourselves both out of debt, if we are in debt, because if you're in debt, you become a slave to the debt. You will do what you have to do to pay the debt, or you lose the asset that holds it. We've seen that happen. You know, people are going crazy because they lose their house, they lose their cars, because they cannot service the debt anymore. But if and Dave Ramsey will tell you this, if you listen to him, if you were debt-free, those things would skate right past you, and you wouldn't even notice them. You'd see other people in trouble, but it wouldn't be bothering you as an individual. We've got to deal with those things, and there'll be things that happen anyway that we've got to deal with. But at least if we can become more resilient, and things happen, and we've got alternatives, we've got ways to go do things. You know, build alliances. I mean, how many people do you know in the church that are farmers? You probably know a few. Do you know where the farmers' markets are? Can you get to them? Can you get stuff? You know, do you put stuff up? And I'm not saying to do all that stuff, okay? I'm just saying that's examples of the way our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were self-sufficient and we're not. You know, we're dependent on electricity. We're dependent on natural gas. We're dependent on gasoline to get us places. We're dependent on the internet. All of the stuff. But you look back at a farmer in Kansas in the 1850s, they weren't dependent on any of that stuff. You know, they were very self-sufficient. And while we can't do all of it, we better do some of it. And I say consider the farmer, because we look at him and say, boy, that was so 1850s. But we may be at a point where that becomes something we need to think about. You know, I've talked about this, and I'm not suggesting we all go out and buy 2 weeks of food. I'm not one of those guys. And, you know, there are people that are selling seed banks, and you can buy backpacks full of food to last 3 weeks, and all that's interesting and all that stuff. But there are things we can do to make our lives simple, and we should do it, because as things change, we'll become more risk tolerant of change, and it'll help us in a lot of ways. And from a personal standpoint, you know, we can do some of those things. The church, I believe, is going to look different than it does now. I believe the church will be more apostate than it is now. And that's hard to think about, but it's going to mean we're seeing a falling away of the church now. I mean, we look at our own numbers, and we see in our own church our numbers are down. Now, is it because people are hurting in the economy? It may be part of it. But, you know, that's the time when you would come to God. After 9/11, the churches were full. After the stock market collapsed, they're not. Why is that? And I think maybe it's because we're beginning to see some of the reaction to what the church has been for the last 30 or 40 years in terms of the way we've taught and the way we're beginning to reap the benefits of that. I think the church will become more media, more entertainment than gospel. And I think we're seeing that now. I think it's rampant in the churches today. And you can go anywhere and look at the high gloss, high glitz, high glitter kind of places, and you can see that. I don't want to pick on anybody, but you take the big TV preacher down in Texas, okay? And there's probably a few of them down there. You listen to him on television, and what you get is a feel-good prosperity message. You don't get biblical teaching. You don't get God's judgment. You don't get any urgency of the second coming. You get a feel-good message. Come in, feel good, donate your money, and we'll all be happy. And people come to that. They're flocking to that. There's tens of thousands of people that come to hear that. I think we'll see behavior that pulls the heartstrings. We see it now. You know, we see, have you ever watched these programs where they, and I'll pick on one of them, the Christian Children's Ministry, or the Smiles Ministry, and they show you a child with a big cleft lip on television, big close-up, and they want you to send $50 or $100 or $200 or whatever. They're not talking about gospel, they're talking about social ministries, and the way they're getting you to do it is by giving you something in your heartstrings that you can't get away from. We see it in the humane societies, we see it in the Save the Whales, we see it in all these organizations who pull at our heartstrings, and they're allied with a lot of faiths, and they do that because that's the way they can get money, and that's the way they can get, you know, people in seats. And they're focused on acceptance and not repentance. They want to be accepted, they want people to accept them, and they want to come in, and they're not focused on repentance, and they're more tolerant of deviancy. I read you that thing Betty Jo gave me a few weeks ago that came from this church up in Dahlonega. You know, and it says, you know, our faith is not based on a person. It's not based on any tradition. It's not based on any dogma. You know, we have faith in ourselves, and you know, it's the new age thing, but it's becoming popular, and people buy that, and they go there, and they hear it. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I also think it's going to be less denominational. You're seeing right now denominations begin to merge and talk about merging, and it's because two giant denominations with giant infrastructure can't support themselves. So they're going together. You know, they'll lay off half of them, and they'll have enough income to support their structure. Yet, is that really what God's plan is? Is that really what we should be doing? I think people are becoming less denominational, and in some ways that's very good, and in some ways it's not very good, because denominations were created because of some distinct beliefs that people had, and those beliefs need to be carried forward, even if it's not under the banner of some, brand, if you would call it that, of Christianity. And I think theology is being replaced by psychobabble preaching. I mean, you see it all the time on television. People that'll say the name of Jesus, and then the other 95% of their talk has nothing to do with Jesus. Yeah. It has to do with healing your mind, healing your spirit, doing all this kind of stuff, which is all kind of the new age, God is in us and we're part of God kind of movement that's be out there. And I think theology is taking a backseat. And I think it'll be the Church of Laodicea, because I think it'll be drawn to the causes. It won't be drawn to the gospel. It'll be drawn to the ways of the world, not to the ways of God. And I think we're beginning to see that come to pass now. We're beginning to see it take place in the churches. And it's important that we do some things that are different. I think the churches are going to have to return to the basics. And I think we're going to have to take a hard look at what God said to us. And maybe the answer is not to have 10,000 people in seats, but to have 1,000 people or 500 people who believe and 500 people who are committed to God. Maybe that's where we go. I don't know. But I think if we don't get back to Bible preaching and teaching, and if we don't, I'll preach a little bit here, if we don't get into the multiple services, we're going to just decline. We're going to hold on. The light will just get smaller and smaller over time, and time will pass, and we'll just sort of fold in. We may be one of the last ones to fold in, but we'll fold in. Testimony that is real. In the early church, people testified to what God was doing in their life. Not some, pablum testimony, but real testimony that people were doing. Music that builds the atmosphere for worship, I think that's important. Music is real important for us. Yeah. And we do that now. We build the atmosphere for worship. In music, we and that's important for us. Discipling our members, that's important. Our members got to know. I mean, you know, the two commandments Jesus said is, you know, love God, and the second one is, you know, love your brothers. And so we've got both of those commandments to deal with. And, you know, by honoring God and worshiping God and preaching and teaching His Word, we honor Him. And then we disciple our members on kind of a horizontal reach, so we'll be able to bring them in. I don't like social gospel. You heard me say this before. Social gospel is fine. It's fine to feed the hungry. It's fine to clothe the poor. It's fine to, you know, fix the children with cleft lips. It's fine to do all of that kind of stuff. But if we do it as a replacement for the gospel, it's the wrong thing for us to do as Christians. We ought to do it as we go to share God. It ought to be part of our plan. We ought to help people everywhere we are. And the works that we do here should be an outgrowth of our evangelism and our mission. Whatever we're committed to do as a church, as a part of that, we do the work that God's called us to do. I'll meddle here. I like one-on-one evangelism. I don't like programs. I don't think programs work. But I think if you go to a neighbor and you sit down and have a talk with them and you tell them what God is doing for you, that's the best witnessing you'll ever have.
Amen.
And then they come to a church and they get convicted by the Holy Spirit, and then they become part of the church. But just going out knocking on the door and opening it and saying, if you died today, are you going to go to heaven? A lot of people will just slam the door in your face and go right on. They won't even listen to what you have to say. And if you can't get to them, you can't teach them and you can't talk with them. So I like that. I think small group study is important. You know, Jim preached about this Sunday, and I think it's real important. I think it's important in Sunday school. I think it's important outside of Sunday school. I think we've got to, as a church, we've got to become more involved in this, either in our communities, or if we don't have communities that have them, we need to start them ourselves, and we need to do this in a very proactive way and invite our neighbors, invite our friends. I don't care whether Presbyterian or Pentecostal or whatever. And if they're brothers and sisters in Christ, you ought to be able to share a gospel time with them and do some good for the kingdom of God. And if you've got a neighbor that's not a Christian, bring them in and have a talk with them as part of the group. You know, don't 10 people jump on them, but, you know, sort of bring them in and have a talk with them. As I mentioned before, I think we're going to see churches, we're seeing them now, go bankrupt, right? We're seeing churches that can't pay their mortgage debts. What do they do from it? There's nothing worse for a witness from God than a church that can't pay its debt and leaves the church to be foreclosed. What a poor witness for God that is. And yet, just like those of us that are house poor, we have to get our house paid off. The church really has to get this church building paid off. Because if you take a look at it, and we get, I don't know how much, you know, we get like $700,000 or $800,000 a year, I guess maybe $1 million when you count all the money that comes in. If we owe $135,000 a year just to pay the interest on the debt, and we owe $2.5 million on the debt of the church, how do we get that paid off? It won't go on forever, and if interest rates go up, we're, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years from now, but we're gonna see a crossing of the lines, and we better be prepared, and we better take some action for that. I'd probably take 25% of our budget and apply it to the paying off the debts. That's probably what I would do. But, you know, that's a pastor finance committee decision. But this is a problem, because we can sail along, and sooner or later, the wall is going to be in front of us. And if we don't recognize it, you know, we may be lucky enough to have somebody die and leave us $2 million. Maybe we will. And that's maybe we ought to take insurance policies out on everybody, and, you know, kick off and get another program idea. But this is a problem for us, and it's looming in the future, just like it looms for you personally. If you're in debt and you've got to find a way to get out of it. And I think if the church, you know, we ought to be focusing all of our energies on discipleship, witnessing, and care for others. I mean, that's what our mission is here, and that's what our focus is, and that's kind of where we ought to be. And I say the church to stay relevant, and I don't mean this church in particular, but the churches in general, people don't find them relevant. They don't come, or they come and they listen and they go away. They just don't find anything compelling here to come and get them involved. And I don't mean here, but it just in general, And that's a problem for churches across the board. And big Baptist churches, big Pentecostal churches, big whatever you call it, they're all suffering from a lack of relevancy to the congregation. It's something we got to figure out what to do with. Well, I'll come back to myself now. What about you and what about me? You know, we need to put God first in our mind interaction. That's the first thing we do. God can't be an afterthought and a P.S. at the bottom of the note. God has got to be the thought that we start and end the day with. And what we do has to be predicated on what he's called us to do. We need to find, if we don't know it, the call that God has given to us. And it doesn't matter whether you're 15 or 85 or 95.
Yeah.
God has given us a call. As long as we're here, we should be attempting to do what God has called us to do. You know, Peter, when Peter got out of the boat to walk to the Lord in that famous scene in Matthew, and Peter got out, and when God said, come, he got out and he walked to him. And as soon as Peter stopped looking at Jesus and started looking at the wind and looking at the water, he sank because he took his eyes off the Lord. And I think that's what we got to do. We got to do that first. And then of course, we got to be in prayer. And I think continual prayer. And I'll tell you, a lot of us have been in prayer pretty continually for months about certain situations involving ourselves and others. And then I think we need to be thankful people. Yeah. We are blessed by God. You know, whatever our problems are, we're blessed by God. We're blessed to be here every day. We're blessed to be here in this country. We're blessed to be here at this church. We're blessed every single day by our health, by whatever amount of money we have to be able to live and do what we do. And I think we need to share that. We need to meet. We need to get out. We need to be committed. And we need to, you know, work with our fellows. I know, let me see where I am here. I want to talk about one final thing, and I know I'm late. These are short slides, but I babble and meddle a little bit, and I'm going to babble and meddle a little more. I want to remind you of something called remnants, wheat, and tares. There's a parable in the Bible called the wheats and the tares, and I've got it listed in there. And let me tell you what it is, in case you don't recognize that. The master plants his garden with pure wheat. He plants the field with pure wheat. In the night, the enemy goes in and puts tares, which are weeds, puts tares in with the wheat. And as the rains come and the garden grows and the wheat and the tare begin to grow, they look a lot alike. And the servants come in and they say, Master, didn't you put pure seed in the field? And he said, yes, I did. The enemy must have sown seed. And they say, do you want us to pull it out? And he says, I don't want you to pull it out. Because if you pull the tares out, you might pull out a piece of wheat. Wait till the harvest time. And in the harvest time, it's easy to separate the wheat from the tares. And I think we're getting close to harvest. I think we're seeing the apostasy of the church. I think God is beginning to pull the remnants of the church together. I think you'll see in the next 5 years, you'll see people begin to, some kinds of movements that are more focused on, you know, doing what God wanted us to do, being about God's business. And I think that's going to happen. And I think the wheat and the tares will be separated at the end time. We can't worry about that. But I would also tell you that what this means is that in the church, we have both wheat and tares. We have wheat and tares. I'm probably speaking to wheat here. But we have wheat and tares. We have people that are not really Christians, but they look like Christians mostly, except they don't really have the fruit of a Christian. They don't really have some of the other characteristics, so we're suspicious of them, just like the servants were. But it's not our call. It's God's call, and God will decide at the end who's the wheat and the tare. I would just ask you to be sure you're a wheat and not a tare, because it makes a big difference. One is taken and burned, and the other one is taken up to heaven. And we ought to look in our minds at what's happening in the world. And we ought to decide in a very predictive way what we're going to do and how we're going to be and what stands we're going to take and what we're going to go do. And I've talked to Jim about this before. Givers and takers, we know them in our lives. There are people that we know that are takers. I don't care what you do for them, they take. They never give, they take. They're not thankful, but they take and they take and they take. And there are people that give and give and give. We want to be givers, not takers. We want to make a difference. We don't want to be stupid about giving, but we want to give to those things that are right, and we want to give with a generous heart and give with an open hand and give with an open heart so that we can, do what God has called us to do. And I would just ask each of us to make a decision before we leave. Are we going to be a difference maker? Are we going to be a giver? Are we going to be a wheat or a tare? Are we going to be part of the remnant? Prayer warriors, witnesses, active participants, whatever you are, it's important to be that. And I want to add one example before I go. It's a good one, Ralph. You can't get too far away, buddy. How many of you saw the movie The Passion of Christ? Okay. What were your impressions of that movie, those of you who remember that? Anybody?
Brutal.
Okay, what else?
Unbelievable.
I
never realized how much I suffered and how I
suffered. It's interesting. We knew it was a movie. We knew the blood wasn't real. We knew the beatings were staged. We knew they were all actors. We knew they were acting a story out that we'd read hundreds and hundreds of times. Yet, that movie reached places in our heart that we didn't know we had. It taught us some things we didn't want to see. And, I remember Vicki sitting there, and she had her, I guess it was the wintertime, and she had some kind of little coat with her, and at certain parts of the scenes, that coat would go up in front of her eyes, and she'd pull it down and go like that. Because some of them were so gruesome, you could hardly see it. And yet, you walked away with the idea that said, he did that for me. He did that for me. Am I worthy of what he did for me? I mean, you ask yourself that question. If it were us, would we do that for somebody else? The beatings, the trouble. And then this one book by David Jeremiah brings another thing out too. How many of you saw Private Ryan? Any of you seen Private Ryan? Okay. One scene in Private Ryan. The Ryan boys go off to war. There's four of them. Three of them get killed in various battles. This one, James Ryan, is over in Europe. He's in France. And he's fighting around Normandy Beach. And his unit is lost. And they can't find him. So the War Department sends a group of men to go find him. A group of probably what you'd call special ops people to go find him and get him out of there because they didn't want the last son of this family being killed in this war. And so they finally found him. And they found him in the middle of a giant battle. And about half of his division or group that he was with had been killed. And they finally got him and got to the commanding officer. A guy named Captain Miller. And Captain Miller had been mortally wounded. And as he was dying, he released this guy to go back home. And he said to him, his name was James Ryan. He said, James, earn this. Earn it. And then he goes on to talk about 80 years later, or 70 years later, he goes to the gravestone of this Captain Miller over in Normandy. Near Omaha Beach, and every time he goes there, he shows the symbol of him saying, I hope I earned it. I hope I earned it. And what he's talking about, the sacrifice they made, did he live up? Was he worth the sacrifice that all these men died so he could be pulled out? 7, 8, 10 people died so he was pulled out. Was he worth it? Was his life worth it? And I guess the question that brings to me, and it ought to bring to you too, is Christ did that for us. We don't think about it every day. But are we worth it? And are we going to be worth it? Are we going to do what we got to do to be worth it? Or are we just going to sit by and watch the world go by? And I'll end there because I think it's important for all of us to think about who we are and what we're going to do. I'll just say that I'm going to join a men's Bible study in the neighborhood that I'm in. It happens suspended for the summer, but it's going to start back. We'll probably start some kind of a Bible group or study home Bible study group. And I would encourage you to do that or find one or plug yourself in and make a difference. Talk about, yeah. Share, learn, read, do the things it takes for you to become a deeper Christian, somebody who's really committed to the faith. So with that, I will leave it in your hands and hopefully no tomatoes. Thank you.